Here are my notes for today. This is what I wrote for myself that I'm supposed to do. So let me do it. I'm supposed to invite you, if you wish, to the talk that I will be giving on Saturday at 11 a.m. at the Fields Institute on the Hilbert 13 problem. And you probably all already picked up the nice and colorful handout that I made for it. I'm supposed to remind you that homework 3 is on the web and there are a few copies over there. And then I'm supposed to follow this handout, which is not as pretty, I'm afraid. So let's do that. Okay? So here is the handout that I am supposed to follow. And the title is Local Fobano Homology. We said we will do a little bit of a detour this week. So here it is. I will tell you in a minute why, or in a few minutes, both why this is an outdated overview and was already outdated on 2008, May 13. So I will tell you about both why this is a bit outdated, but also why is it relevant? Why is it somehow a part of the subject, even if we don't know yet that it's a part of the subject, even if we don't exactly know how it is a part of the subject? Anyway, first of all, let me state the main theorem, okay? So the main theorem or point, it's more than one theorem somehow, is that the cube, which we will discuss later and which appears on your handout, okay, this big three-dimensional cube, and in fact generally n-dimensional cube, called KH of Hovanov of L, where L is a link, is an up-to-homotopy invariant of knots and links. We'll come to it in a minute. Furthermore, it's Euler characteristic, so it's a little bit like a homology theory, and it has a Euler characteristic, and the Euler characteristic for homology, I'm assuming you all know that, right? Because I did ask you and you said you knew homology. Is it right? So the Euler characteristic is somehow the alternating sum of the dimensions, so it's definitely weaker than the homology as a whole. And the Euler characteristic is the Jones polynomial. Well, you'll say that the Jones polynomial is not a number, right? But it is just a sequence of numbers. The coefficients of each power, the coefficient of each power of q is a number. So likewise, we will see that the cube that I haven't yet displayed is somehow layered, and each layer has an Euler characteristic, and its Euler characteristic is the corresponding coefficient of the Jones polynomial. So in short, I will just say that the Euler characteristic of the whole cube is the Jones polynomial. So it is definitely as strong as the Jones polynomial. But in fact, it is strictly stronger than the Jones polynomial by direct computation. Furthermore, it is in some sense functorial. So you know, the Euler characteristic of a space is an invariant of a space. But if you have a map between two spaces, generally speaking, you cannot say anything about how their Euler characteristics are related. Okay? Whereas the homology lifts. Okay? I mean, for the homology, if you have a map between two spaces, you have a map between the homologies. So in some sense, there is a similar sense in which the Hovanov homology is functorial, in the appropriate sense. And finally, I will tell you that it is practically computable. So that's the list of goals for today. Now, why do I care? So, you know, one reason that I care is that it is strictly stronger than the Jones polynomial. This is nice, but you know, if you attended yesterday's talk, you know that knot invariant or polynomial knot invariants are not really for separating knots. So this is in itself is not enough, okay? The fact that it is functorial allows you to prove new theorems, okay? And this is a more valuable piece of the story, but I will not go as far. I will only indicate briefly what which way you go, okay, but I will not go that far. And maybe the most interesting reason to care about it is that it suggests, so you see, this is something that is, it is a certain homologification, lifting to the level of homology from the level of Euler characteristics of the Jones polynomial. But, you know, when the Jones polynomial first came in, what was it, 82 or so, it opened the floodgates. And within a few years, lots of other new invariants came up. And it turned out that there was a direct relationship between knot theory and Lie algebras, and that was never suspected before. I mean, by now you know about it because you heard parts of the story in this class. But sort of the moment Chovanov told us that the Jones polynomial is actually the shadow of something bigger, it raises the question, how much of the rest of the flood that came after the Jones polynomial is also of a shadow of something bigger? And how much of the theory, how much of the theory of representations of Lie groups is also, in some sense, the shadow of something bigger? Okay? So I'll call it the categorification speculative paradigm, and I'll say it in such a vast generality that it's obviously false. But the point about it is not that it is false or true. It's not meant to be true or false. It's not a theorem or a conjecture. It's a paradigm. And the point about it is that we want to know to what extent is it true. Okay? So every object in mathematics is really the Euler characteristic of some fancier object. Okay? And of course, this is meaningless as stated. It should be every object with integer coefficients is somehow the Euler characteristic in the appropriate sense, okay? But again, this is a paradigm. And likewise, every operation between objects lifts to an operation between complexes, and likewise, every identity between operations remains true, perhaps only up to homotopy of complexes. Okay, so this is the paradigm stated in a very loose language, okay? Now, why is this talk not up to date? I think I already told you why the subject might be interesting. Whether you bought it or not, I don't know, but I told you. Okay? But why is it not up to date? It's not up to date because even at the time that I made this handout, more objects have already been shown to fall into this paradigm. And by now, even more. So the Alexander polynomial falls into this paradigm, the Homfli polynomial falls into this paradigm. This is the so-called Chovanov-Rozansky homology. More recently, various parts of the theory of quantum groups had fallen into this paradigm. This is the work of Chovanov and Lauda. But I think the big picture is still missing. Okay? So, I mean, it is still not true, it is still not known how far does it go. Okay, and it's still not being made to, being brought to its most basic form. Okay, so the work of Chovanov and Lauda and Chovanov and Rozansky shows that things can be done for the Homfli polynomial, but hopefully they are, or for general quantum groups, but hopefully they can also be done better. Okay? So, now let's start with content. So, just to remind you, we are seeking to generalize the Jones polynomial. Here is the definition of the Jones polynomial in three little formulas. So, first of all, you know, when I first introduced the Jones polynomial, I used variables A, and then I changed variables to Q. This is written already in terms of Q. Second, when I first introduced the Jones polynomial, I introduced it using the Kaufmann bracket, which was something like a crossing goes to A times one type of smoothing plus A inverse times another type of smoothing, and I don't want to commit myself to right now to whether or not this is the correct sign of crossing and whether or not I put the A and the A inverse in the right place, okay? But that was it schematically. And then we said the Jones polynomial is equal to some power of Q, or some Q to some power, maybe it was 3/4 or something like that, or -3/4, I don't remember, times the right of the knot, times the Jones bracket, times the Kaufman bracket, okay? But you see, I can combine the two definitions and remember that the right of an overcrossing, of an undercrossing, is -1, sorry, an undercrossing goes by the right to -1, and then Q to that power will be, well, whatever. I mean, this goes by the right to -1, this goes by the right to +1, so I could simply split this part of the definition to two pieces, the positive piece and the negative piece, and I get what I wrote here. So the overcrossing becomes, so I factor in the powers of Q, so instead of A and A inverse, I get Q times the zero smoothing minus Q inverse times the one smoothing, and for the undercrossing, I get minus Q to the -2 times the zero smoothing plus Q to the -1 times the one smoothing. Okay? So you'll just have to trust me that the arithmetic is done right, but it's high school arithmetic, so there is a potential that it's done right. Okay? And then finally, an unknotted component for the Jones polynomial was worth minus a squared minus 1 over a squared or something like that. And in the new variables, it just becomes Q plus Q inverse. So this is what I seek to imitate. Okay? Now, if you have a complicated knot, say this one, if you have a complicated knot, say this one, computing the Jones polynomial amounts to replacing every crossing either by a one smoothing or by a zero smoothing. So you get 2 to the n things, 2 to the n smoothings, and the main cube is just a cube made out of these 2 to the n things. So on Tuesday I described this cube already. Should I describe it again? No? 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 Okay, very, very quickly. Sorry, everybody says no, but I will still describe it very, very quickly. You have a smoothing on each vertex. You have a cobordism between two smoothings on every edge. Okay? You have a few signs placed in various places. And you have degree and height shifts. So the height shifts appear in light blue and you cannot see them on the screen. I can because I'm right here, but I'm sure you can't, but you can see it on the handout. Okay? And you also have degree shifts which appear in orange. And again, you can just barely see them on the screen. You can possibly see them on the handout. Let me say that the blue stuff will become the homological degree. So, you know, in a complex, you have chain spaces of various dimensions, okay? Or I will call it height, of various heights. So, you know, a complex looks like omega 7 goes to omega 8 goes to omega 9 with a differential. And this number I will call A, the height, okay? So this is the stuff that appears in blue, and it's essentially, up to a shift, just the number of one smoothings. So it would be 0 here and 3 here, up to some minor shifts, okay? And the orange number is the degree. It's what I said before. It's what corresponds to the power of Q of the in the Jones polynomial. So really, you should be thinking of this picture as having as embedded, perhaps in a higher dimensional space. Okay, with different pieces of different colors, of different orange degree, lying on different floors. And then you have to be careful to see that everything that I will do respects this division into floors. So that at the end, the results is not just that the cube is invariant, but also each part of it in each floor is invariant. But again, on first iteration, it's better not to think about these numbers. It's better not to think about this extra piece of information. Okay? The fact that it is preserved is essentially only bookkeeping. And we want to see the big picture and not the bookkeeping. Okay? Anyway, so now a little bit more slowly. So the signs come from this picture. Did I tell you, should I remind you, should I describe what this picture is? So basically, in general, if you look at the exterior algebra on n generators, let's call them dxi, sorry, the full exterior algebra on n generators dxi, then this is an algebra of dimension 2 to the n. The generators are just differential forms, or the differential form of the differential forms, without the functions, without the coefficients, okay? So these are things like dx1 wedge dx2 wedge dx7 wedge dx8. So basically, whenever you have a subset of the integers from 1 to n, thanks, Peter, whenever you have a subset of the integers from 1 to n, you have a generator of the exterior algebra. Now, these generators arrange themselves into a cube in a natural way, right? Whenever you have 2 to the n corresponding to subsets, you can convert it into the coordinates of in a cube. And the three-dimensional case is shown here. Okay? Now, the exterior algebra is generated by n generators, dx1 up to dxn. And in three dimensions, these would be dx, dy, dz. And the arrows correspond to wedging with dx, or wedging with dy, or wedging with dz. So all the horizontal arrows are wedging with dy. All the upwards going arrows are wedged with dx, and all the downward going arrows are wedged with dz. Okay? Now, wedging with these with the generators will take you from a basis element, either from a basis element to another basis element, or from a basis element to its negative. So say if you go from dz to dx wedged dz by wedging with dx, because we're going upwards, you actually come to dz wedge dx, which is the negative of dx wedge dz. And so you put a minus sign here. So that's where the signs are coming from. Okay? Having said all this nonsense, the only interesting thing, the only interesting property of the exterior algebra that I will use is the fact that dxi wedge dxj is equal to the negative of dxj wedge dxi. And this translates to the fact that in this cube, if you if you go twice, you have two ways of getting to the same endpoint, right? Because you can either go, well, basically, if you go twice, you're going along the sides of a two-dimensional face of this n-dimensional cube, and you can go along the other side of that face. And the only interesting property of the signs is that when you go one way, you get the negative of what you do, of what you get when you go the other way. Okay? And this is this fact over here. Okay. Now, so we said we would do it briefly, so I'm skipping several things. This would be the four-dimensional case. And this I already said. And right, and the next thing was, I was supposed to tell you where does this cube lives. So again, I told you that already on Tuesday, but let me quickly review it. Okay? So first of all, the edges of the cube are cobordisms, so they live in the category of cobordisms. The category of cobordisms has objects, one-dimensional manifolds drawn in the plane, okay? So the objects are smoothings drawn in a plane, and the morphism between two smoothings would be a two-dimensional surface lying in between, regarded up to isotropy. Composition would be the obvious stacking, and you can stack things on top of each other only if the middle layer agrees. So that's why it's a category and not a group or something. Okay? And here is the fact that, or here is an illustration of the fact that I'm thinking of things up to homotopy. So this picture is equal to that picture. Okay? Second, you extend, so later I will take this category of cobordisms and mod out by various local relations. I will do it later. At the moment, I first want to extend it to matrices over cobordisms, and I think I told you what that is already before, so I will not repeat it. Basically, the objects are column vectors of smoothings, and the morphisms are matrices or bundles of arrows of cobordisms going between those smoothings, where I also allow formal linear combinations. So here is one object, here is another object, and the composition is matrix multiplication. Okay, generalized to work on in the category of cobordisms. Okay. Okay, sorry. So again, my goal right now, maybe I should copy the phrase that I'm trying to explain. So my goal is to tell you that the cube lives in complexes over matrices, over cobordisms, over local relations, modulo homotopy. I've already explained. Yellow is a good color, isn't it? So I've already explained cobordisms. I've already explained matrices. Let me remind you what complexes are. So complexes are complexes in an arbitrary category, okay? Not necessarily vector spaces, are just chains of objects beginning from a certain object and ending in some other object. And to make something that I didn't make clear last time a bit clearer, really you should be thinking of it as infinite, extended to the left by infinitely many zeros, and extended to the right by infinitely many zeros. Remember that our just to explain what's zero. So zero is the empty column vector. Okay. Anyway, so complexes are just chains of objects with morphisms between them, always called D. So that whenever you go two steps with D, you get zero. Okay? Again, what's zero? Zero is the, remember that I'm allowing formal linear combinations, so it's the formal linear combination, the empty formal linear combination, or all coefficients are equal to zero. Okay. Now, a morphism between two complexes is, well, if you have two complexes, a morphism is a chain of arrows going from the objects of one complex to the objects of the other complex so that all squares commute. And again, if you've seen homology theory, this is the exact same thing, except instead of saying vector spaces, I'm allowing objects in an arbitrary so-called additive category, and a category in which zero makes sense. Okay? And likewise, so okay, homology makes no sense. To define homology in a general category, well, you cannot define homology in a general category because homology is the kernel of this modulo the image of that, but kernels and images don't make sense in this generality. However, homotopy does make sense. Okay? So you say that two morphisms between two complexes. So here are two complexes, the omega zero complex, the omega one complex, and two morphisms between them, the F morphism and the G morphism. You say that they are homotopic if they satisfy the same formula that homotopic morphisms in ordinary algebraic topology or in ordinary homological algebra satisfy. Meaning, if F minus G is equal to H times D plus D times H, where H is a certain diagonally going collection of morphisms. Again, am I right to assume that all of this is a review to all of you? Except, Sorry, I'm always looking at the same people because these are the people I know less. So that definition has the same formal properties that homotopies have in vector spaces. So basically, if you can prove something by diagram chase alone, it would be true in these settings just as well. Okay? Sorry, not all kinds of diagram chase. Diagram by compositions alone, without ever having to look at kernels and images. Okay? So, in particular, the relation of homotopy between morphisms is an equivalence relation. It is in some sense an ideal. So in other words, if you had a third complex down here, and you had a morphism going down to the third, then if you had, so let's call the next morphism K, okay? Then the claim would be that K composed with F is homotopic to K composed with G, if F and G were homotopic to start with. And likewise, if you have if you compose the other way. Okay? Finally, this means that you can define homotopy equivalence. So two complexes are called homotopy equivalent if they satisfy the same formal property that you would using algebraic topology. Okay? So two complexes are homotopy equivalent if there is a morphism from one to the other and a morphism going backwards, so that both compositions are homotopic to the identity, to the corresponding identities. And again, this is an equivalence relation. Okay? Because basically the same proofs that made all of this work in ordinary homological algebra work just as well here. Okay, so I've explained complexes, and I've also explained homotopy. Now, let's go back to the main picture. And as I said last time, what we see here is a complex, okay, with every column is a column vector. Every space between two columns is a column vector of smoothings. Every space between columns is a bundle or a matrix of cobordisms. And we have to check that d squared is equal to zero, Well, what's d squared? So say, going from here to here, there are two ways to go. Either you first smooth the this crossing, okay, so sorry, you first re-smooth this crossing, so you first apply, you first put a saddle going from here to here, and then a saddle in this space, or you do it the other way around. So as cobordisms, this composition and this composition look exactly like the image that I've shown over here. Okay? On one side, you first put the saddle in one place and then in the other place, and on the other side, you've done it in the opposite order. As I said, these are the same. So therefore, as cobordisms without signs, going from here to here this way or that way is the same. But remember that I've inserted these signs, and remember that the only interesting property of those signs was that when you go around the square in two different ways, you get a minus sign. So with the signs included, d squared is equal to zero, because the two ways of going two layers up always cancel. Are you with me? Is this okay? And again, I'm sorry for always staring at the same people. Is this still okay? Okay. Where were we? No, we went too far. Okay. Oh, so again, the claim, I told you what the cube was. I told you where it lives. It lives in complexes over matrices over cobordisms. I failed to tell you what the local relations are. And without the local relations, the statement that this is an invariant will be false. So I'd better tell you about the local relations. So mod out cobordisms by a few further relations. Okay, so the real category I'm working with is not cobordisms, but cobordisms modulo a few relations. Okay? These relations are all local. So, the composition operation remains well-defined, okay? So everything that I said still makes sense even when you mod out by these relations. Anyway, what are the relations? The first relation is the S relation, and it says that if you have a sphere, it's equal to zero. So you see, a cobordism is a two-dimensional surface going from the top to connecting some doodle at the top to a doodle at the bottom. I never said a connected surface. So in fact, it could have a disconnected component, which is in fact not connected to the top of and the bottom. So there could be a sphere floating here. The relation I mod out by is that whenever you see a sphere, it's zero. Remember that I allowed formal linear combinations, so zero makes sense. Okay. Likewise, whenever you see a torus floating somewhere, it's equal to 2. So this is much in the spirit of the Kaufmann bracket relation, saying that this is equal to Q plus Q inverse. This really means that if you have a floating circle and then more stuff, you can pull out Q plus, you can kill the circle, replace it by Q plus Q inverse, and keep the rest of the stuff. Okay? So this is in a similar spirit. So if you have a torus and a bigger chunk and a further cobordism, you can erase the torus but multiply the whole thing by 2. And again, since I'm allowing formal linear combinations, it makes sense. Okay, the next relation is the relation G, which says that if you have genus 2 or more anywhere, it's equal to zero. So remember, notice that I've left a circle here. So this circle could connect to the rest of the coordinates. So in other words, if I have this, again, I have my surface here, and out of it, again, not as a separate connected component, but within it, somewhere, you can find a circle, so that on the other side of the circle, you have a genus 2 thing, kill it, set it to zero. Okay? And then the last relation is the so-called neck-cutting relation. And it says that if you have a neck within the cobordism, you can cut the neck. And, you know, it's a joke that I've recycled too many times, but, you know, that's why it's in red. But anyway, you can cut the neck and replace it by a sum of two possibilities. Either a cap on one side and a genus 1 cap on the other side, or the same thing but the other way around. Okay? And again, this is sort of this, in the same spirit of the Kaufman bracket. Okay? This relation in the Kaufman bracket. And again, it's and I forgot the factor of 2. So really, I mean, this is equal to 1 half that plus 1 half that. Okay. Good. So now the claim is complete. Now the statement is complete, not the proof. The statement is that the cube now shown on the blackboard, which lives in this horrible space, is an invariant. And furthermore, it is stronger than the Jones polynomial and functorial and I don't know what else it does. Okay. So the main thing, the first thing I should do is I should prove to you that it is an invariant. Okay? So since the construction was somehow an imitation of the Jones polynomial or a push-up of the Jones polynomial, let me remind you how you prove that the Jones polynomial is invariant. So the most interesting invariance for the Jones polynomial is the invariance under Rademeister 2, and here's the proof. You start from one side of the Jones polynomial, of the Rademeister 2 move. It has two crossings. You replace each one of them by the two possible smoothings. You get a sum of 4 terms. In one of the 4 terms, you have a circle. In the Jones polynomial, a circle is worth q plus q inverse. So I remove the circle and replace it by q plus q inverse. And then I looked at what remained, and it turns out that what? This cancels that. This cancels that. And the only thing that remains is this, which I wrote here, and this is the other side of the Rademeister 2 move, QED. Okay, sorry, this is just a review. Okay? Now I want to imitate this proof at this much higher, at this homological level, and I need 3 ingredients before I can do that. And I'll tell you what the ingredients are, and then I'll tell you how I get them in the more general picture. Well, first of all, I need to extend everything to tangles. The picture as drawn sort of made sense for the whole knot. Okay? But now I need to somehow tell you how to localize and stare only at a part of a knot. Okay? So that's first thing that I need to do. Okay? The second thing that I need to do is I need to tell you how in homology or in complexes modulo homotopy, a circle is worth 2 empty sets. Okay? Because you see, I mean, removing the circle just means that the circle gets replaced by 2 empty sets and the rest stays. Okay? So I have to somehow tell you how on the level of complexes you can make this substitution, circle is equal to two empty sets. And finally, I need to tell you, again, on the level of complexes, if you have a complicated complex with lots of terms in it, when are you allowed to cancel? Again, on the level of Euler characteristics, you cancel things when they look alike. How do you cancel things in this world of complexes over an arbitrary, over a funny category, modulo homotopy? So these are the three things I need to tell you. Is it okay? Is it clear what I need to say? Okay? Okay. So the first one is, well, in some sense, the easiest. So what do you do in the case of tangles? What if you have just a piece of a knot rather than a whole knot? The answer is you do exactly the same. Okay? So, but that's a bit naive. Anyway, first of all, here is a tangle. Here is a piece of a knot bound within a disk. Okay? I do the exact same thing. I look at all possible smoothings of this tangle. I look at going between two smoothings. So if I go from this smoothing to that smoothing, the only difference is that this area changed from being a zero smoothing to a one smoothing. So what I put in between is a cobordism in which you have a saddle in the right place. Oh, sorry, this saddle corresponds to going from here to here. Sorry. Okay? So everything is exactly the same. The only difference is extremely minor, and this is that my cobordisms now, instead of going from smoothings in the whole plane to smoothings in the whole plane, they go from a smoothing on a disk to a smoothing on a disk. And then they also have, so their boundary is not just the top and bottom boundary, but also they are allowed to have boundaries on the side. And the boundaries on the side are just the boundaries of the tangles at the top and the bottom across the interval. Okay? So that's the only difference. And the signs come in the same way, and the degree shifts come in the same way, and everything is otherwise exactly the same. Okay? So in fact, we will prove a stronger statement. We will prove that the invariant of tangles is, or the cube that is associated with tangles is invariant. Okay? Here is the little subtlety, not subtlety, I mean, the real point about tangles is not that you can extend to tangles, but that if you know the extension to tangles, you can reconstruct the invariant. So in other words, the real point about tangles is not, as I said, that you can extend, but that if you have a big knot, here is a big knot, and observe my usual lack of imagination, it's the trefoil. And suppose I cut it in two, so on the left I have a tangle with two crossings, and the disc actually looks a bit like, well, half a disc, but it's still a disc. And on the right, sorry, only one crossing on the left, sorry. And on the right, I again have a tangle now with two crossings. In fact, it's the same tangle that's shown over here, twisted. Okay? What I need to tell you is, well, let's call this tangle T1 and this tangle T2. And the whole thing, let's call it L. Okay? I need to tell you that if you know the cube of T1, and if you know the cube of T2, I need to tell you how to reconstruct the cube of L. Okay? If I was able to do that, then if I made a change to T1, or if I made a Rademeister move, sorry, on T2, and I knew that K of T2 didn't change, it would mean that the output doesn't change either. So I need to tell you how to kind of make an arrow here so that, so as to make the diagram commutative, so as to make multiplication of tangles correspond to multiplication of complexes. Anyway, how do you multiply complexes? So, in ordinary vector space complexes or homological algebra, there is a notion of taking the tensor product of two complexes, omega 0 and omega 1, okay? And the notion is, well, omega 0 times omega 1 in height r is equal to the direct sum of omega 0 at r1 tensor omega 1 at r2, where you take the direct sum over all r1 plus r2 is equal to r, okay? Or it's perhaps, and then there is a differential defined on that. And perhaps it's better to draw this formula in the plane. So if you have omega 0 r minus 1 going to omega 0 r going into omega 0 r plus 1, and you also have omega 1 r minus 1, it's not necessarily the same r, so let's make it r0. And here, omega 0 r1 minus 1 going into omega 1, sorry, r1 going into omega 1 r1 plus 1, you take tensor products. So here you put the tensor product of this and that. Here you put the tensor product of that and that. So you basically make an array of tensor products. Okay? And then you look at the diagonals. So in the tensor product space, the degree R0 plus R1 minus 2 piece will have this summand in it. The next degree will have this summand in it. The next degree will have that summand in it. The next degree will have, oh, I missed one dot, will have that summand in it, and the next degree will have that summand in it. And the differential will be, well, going from here to the next level, you can go in two ways, either by using the differential in one complex, tensor trivially by the other complex, by the chain space, by a certain chain space of the other complex, or going that way, and then you have to sprinkle in, so basically you continue with this, and then you have to sprinkle in some signs. Okay? So to generalize it to the case of tangle, so to generalize it to the case shown here, you just generalize it. You just do the exact same thing. So if you have a complex for one tangle, it will be a certain chain of spaces with smoothings for that tangle. The complex for the other tangle will be a certain chain of spaces with smoothings for the other tangle. And then you will to form the tensor product, you will look at the direct sum of all things like this, and the only thing I need to explain is what's tensor product. Tensor product is just, right, I need to tell you how to tensor product two objects. Tensor product is just to put the two objects side by side. Remember that the objects for one tangle, over here, the objects will be, smoothings living within within this half, within this half of the disk. For this tangle, the smoothings will be smoothings living within this half disks, and the tensor product operation will be just to glue them side by side. Okay? So I just gave you a meaningful way of taking the tensor products of these two complexes. And the claim will be that the tensor product of these two complexes, oh, I should have said, likewise for cobordisms. Cobordisms can also be glued by putting them side by side. Okay? So I just gave you a meaningful operation that goes from this complex and this complex into complexes here, complexes for L. And the claim is that KH of L really is the tensor product of KH of T1 with KH of T2. Okay? And I think I'd rather skip the proof, but all that it is the fact that you know, if you have an n-dimensional, if you multiply a three-dimensional cube by a seven-dimensional cube, the result is a ten-dimensional cube. Okay? So in other words, if you have a link with three crossings on the left and seven crossings on the right, then the Chovanov cube of it will be made out of the 2 to the 10 ways of smoothing everything, but you could have just as well constructed it from the 2 to the 3 ways of smoothing the left, glued with the 2 to the 7 ways in all possible ways of smoothing the right. Okay? Is this too much or?
So, if we cut up the link in different ways, so, like, yeah. I don't have to cut it up in two pieces. Like, what if
no,
I do more?
So, in fact,
what
it
happens?
Is more general. So, in fact, the big link in itself could be a tangle. So, I mean, really, I'm asserting something a bit stronger. I'm asserting that if you have... any tangle T, okay, which is made out of two pieces, T1 and T2, okay, so I mean the two pieces have some interface, but you could have any T2 here, and in fact it could connect to the outside as well, and any T1 here, and it could connect to the outside, then the claim is that K of T1 tensor in the sense explained over there, Q of T2 is equal to Q of T1 connect T2. Okay?
And so it's and associative as well if we do three? Or
once I wrote this formula,
then it is.
And I know that connect sum is associative, it follows that it's associative on the image at least, okay? But yes, it's associative. Okay? But again, the reason it is associative, the reason you can sort of iterate this is that basically what you do is independent for T1 as for T2. What happens is, you look at all smoothings of T1, you look at all smoothings of T2, they never, somehow what happens is independent. So, yeah. Okay? So this said, if I want to prove Rademeister 2, given that I know that I reconstruct big things from small things, it's enough to prove Rademeister 2 for this small thing. Okay, it's enough to show that, well, it's enough to do it in the same way as for the Jones polynomial. By the way, even for the Jones polynomial, strictly speaking, this picture isn't the whole proof of invariance under Rademeister 2. Even for the Jones polynomial, when you drew this picture, it becomes a proof in either of two ways. Either by saying the Jones polynomial extends to tangles and we've done and it's enough to show invariance for tangles, and then you have to explain how to extend the Jones polynomial for tangles, or by saying this is actually a part of the proof of the picture, and really each of these symbols stands not just for itself, but for a whole huge family of smoothings that depends on what happens on the outside. Okay? So there is a similar... So this is sort of a short of a proof in a similar way to... In a similar way to our case. I just had to explain how to make our shortened proof into a bigger... into the big thing. Okay. And there are many gaps, okay? I should have told you that just like in ordinary homological algebra, homotopy equivalence on one side of the tensor product induces homotopy equivalence on the tensor product. Okay, so in other words, you know, with this definition of tensor product of complexes, if you replace one of the components by a homotopy equivalent one, the tensor product comes out homotopy equivalent. Okay, there are lots of technical things to show, and they're all completely identical to the relevant case in ordinary homological algebra. So we're like 10 minutes time past the time for break. Should we take a break or just go ahead and finish it? I obey orders. Just finish?
Take a break.
Okay. What?
Take a break.
Take a break. Okay, let's take a 5 minutes break. Is this fair? Okay.